How many of you have heard the statement, half of all marriages end in divorce? Well, I got good news and bad news. Bad news is that is there's a little bit of truth to that. Good news is that's not true. I want to break down, I have seen that statistic ever since I've been preaching. And in the early years of my preaching, I actually used that statistic, and then finally I realized that statistic isn't good. So let me show you what's going on. First of all, here's how they get that number. Every year, there's around 2 million divorces per year, and that's supposed to say 2 million marriages per year, I'm sorry. And if I got that right, maybe I'd make sense. There's around 2 million marriages per year, about 2 million couples are formed every year, and about 1 million people get 1 million couples get divorced every year. And that's where that number comes from. And if you look at that, you're thinking, man, marriage is in sad, sad shape. One other number I want to throw up here is there are almost 1 million couples where one of them dies every year. So roughly the same number of divorces and the same number of marriages that are ended by death. That's where that number comes from, okay? The half of all marriages. Now, there's something that's not telling you, though. What that does not address is there's a whole bunch of marriages out there that don't fall into any of those three categories. And that's why that number is deceptive. I want you to look at a graph. To put things in perspective, now, that first category is the two, if you look on the left, the little blue thing, that is the 2.1 marriages per year. The red thing is the 1 million divorces per year. The little yellow thing is the 0.9 million widowed couples per year. That big tall thing on the right, that is all of the marriages, roughly 50 million marriages that don't fall into the other three categories. In other words, there are 50 million marriages where nobody got married, they were already married, they didn't get divorced, the marriage is still intact, and nobody died. And that's really the true statistical picture of what's going on in marriage. So when somebody says half of all marriages end in divorce, that just isn't true. That's not a proper use of the statistics. Again, it goes back to the marriage rate. Yes, roughly there are half as many divorces granted in a year as there are marriages in a year. And even that number is a little bit deceptive, because one of the other factors in looking at the divorce rate is the number of people who have been divorced multiple times. And that's actually a very high number. A lot of people get married, they get divorced, they get married again, and then they get divorced again. That's a fairly high number. So even that skews the numbers a little bit. All of this is to say that I think marriage overall, even though, yes, divorce rates are unacceptably high, even though it's a sad thing, the overall health of marriage is actually quite good in our culture. Marriage is a very stable institution, and I would expect that. If marriage is something that God Himself designed, I would expect that it would have durability. I would expect that it would survive a lot of things, and the numbers, I think, actually show that. The problem started back in the 80s in the United States when they introduced the idea of no-fault divorces, I think came out in 1969. And within a few years, the divorce rate increased by about 25% each year, and it stayed elevated since then. The highest rates were in the early 80s, but have since dropped off. I haven't done any number crunching in a few years, but the numbers have been fairly stable for some time. Now, the problem for Christians is that as the divorce rate has climbed in culture, it has also climbed among Christians. Now, again, there's good news and bad news. If you look at some of the polls, some of the religious polls that are taken among people who call themselves Christians, and that's Christian in the absolute loosest sense, yes, the divorce rate is fairly high. In fact, it comes close to matching the divorce rate among in our culture, period. Now, the good news is if you poll people who are fairly conservative religiously and who are very active in their churches and they take seriously Bible study and prayer and things like that, religiously active people, the divorce rate is much, much lower. But nonetheless, when we start talking about divorce, that's never good. And there's not any good side to the aspects of divorce that we see both in our culture and also in the church. Another problem that you have when you start talking about marriage and divorce is just the bewildering variety of views on marriage and divorce and remarriage. I've got book on top of book on top of book in my library, and some of them I start reading them and I put them down after a few pages like, this is nuts. Just some of the viewpoints that people come up with trying to defend whatever view that they have. It's sad that we have taken the basic teachings of Scripture and gone in so many directions with it. A number of years ago, when I first moved to Louisville back in 2002, I think a year or two later, there was a debate in Western Kentucky with a couple of Christians about some issues regarding marriage and divorce. And it was a very well-done debate. Everybody conducted themselves properly. I thought everyone did a good job defending their views and so forth. It was a very amicable atmosphere. But I couldn't help but thinking that somewhere in the corner of that room, the devil was sitting there with a smile on his face because he got Christians to disagree about it. And that's sad. I don't think that any one sermon on marriage and divorce is going to solve all issues, but I do want to just talk about it tonight, just talk about some of the basic teachings regarding divorce. And I even hate the title of this, Biblical Divorce. Well, there is a biblical position on divorce, but I don't even like to think of it in those terms. We do have to address it because it comes up in our culture and it comes up in among Christians sometimes, and the Bible does teach about it. We're going to spend most of our time in Matthew chapter 19, but I want to look at several things besides that. I want to start by going back to the Old Testament. Go back to Deuteronomy chapter 24, because a discussion of Matthew 19 by default has to go back to Deuteronomy 24, because that's where the discussion originates. Back in Deuteronomy chapter 24, I want to read the opening verses of the text. Deuteronomy 24, starting in verse 1. It says, "Now when a man takes a wife and marries her, if she then finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, and she departs out of his house, and if she goes and becomes another man's wife, and the latter man hates her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter man dies who took her to be his wife, then her former husband who sent her away may not take her again to be his wife after she has been defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin upon the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance." Now that's straightforward enough. Now I do want to point out one thing, the kind of law that this is. Under the law of Moses, there's two basic kinds of laws. There's one kind that is sort of like the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt do this, thou shalt not do that. They're really absolute types of prohibitions. Then you have this kind. This is called case law. And the way you recognize it is just how it begins. You have a set of circumstances when this happens and this happens and this happens, then you do this, this, and this. And a lot of times the emphasis is on the procedure. But the way these case laws worked, this just kind of gave a set of conditions, and it was basically saying when you have this, this is basically how you proceed. Now, it also allowed, these types of case laws also allowed that there might be some cases that didn't exactly meet these criteria, but they would kind of fall under the umbrella of a passage like Deuteronomy 24. And if that were the case, then the Jewish leaders of the community or the priests or whoever was dealing with the case would have to infer some things beyond that. And that really, I think, when we get over to Matthew chapter 19, that becomes part of the discussion. And nonetheless, this is an example of case law. Prior to this, in the Old Testament, in the law of Moses, there's not really any detailed commands about divorce. There are some references to divorce, but there's really not a lot of prior commands that go into this kind of detail prior to Deuteronomy chapter 24. Secondly, I don't think that this is defining what divorce was or adultery or anything like that. It's treating an existing situation. Most scholars, when they look at this, recognize that what Moses was doing here was regulating an existing practice. And again, the fact that he uses this as case law underlines that fact. Notice how it begins. When this happens, that assumes it was happening. Now, this is near the end of Moses' life. He's preparing the new generation to go into the promised land. And this is one of many laws that he gives in the book of Deuteronomy. He's kind of summarizing what we saw back in Exodus and Leviticus and maybe even parts of Numbers. But what he's saying is when you get into the promised land, these are some situations that you may encounter. This text assumes that some people were already getting divorced. But what he wants to address is a particular set of situations. He's not commanding something new. Now, what are the grounds for the divorce that he talks about here? Well, again, he says, when a man takes a wife and marries her, if she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her. The English Standard, New American Standard say some indecency. NIV is similar. It says something indecent. King James says some uncleanness. Holman Christian Standard says something improper. The Hebrew phrase that's used there is davar or va. And there's a lot of discussion over exactly what that means. There's not a lot of agreement over it. In fact, before that, he actually says, if she finds no favor in his eyes because of this indecency. And what happened was, as the rabbis got hold of this, and as different Jewish sects got hold of this, they started running in every conceivable direction because by the nature of the case, the language is ambiguous. It could have referred to barrenness. It might have referred to a birth defect. It might have referred to menstrual impurity. It could have included sexual impropriety. I'm not convinced that he's talking here about just plain old adultery, and here's why. You go back to Deuteronomy chapter 22, a couple of chapters earlier, down in verse 22, if a man is found lying with the wife of another man, both of them shall die, the man who lay with the woman and the woman, so you shall purge the evil from Israel. What do you do if somebody's caught in the act of adultery? That's what you do. This text in Deuteronomy 24 says nothing about that, says nothing about the death penalty, which makes me suspect that this is not dealing primarily with adultery, because that had a totally different punishment. This is dealing with how you regulate what is going on in these situations with divorce. And not only that, but also you go back to Leviticus chapter 20. Other passages spoke about some other situations. Leviticus chapter 20, down in verse 10, if a man commits adultery with the wife of his neighbor, both the adulterer and the adulteress shall be surely put to death. Again, speaking about adultery in particular, the death penalty. And again, Deuteronomy 24 mentions nothing about that, which makes me lean in the direction that this is not really talking about adultery. It is that vague phrase, some kind of indecency. And you could also add one other caveat, I think, that is important. In some cases in the law, go back to Deuteronomy 21. Deuteronomy 21, there's a paragraph starting in verse 10 that dealt with the marriage of foreign female captives. Deuteronomy 21, verse 10, when you go out to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God gives them into your hand, and you take them captive, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman, and you desire to take her to be your wife, and you bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head and pare her nails, and she shall take off the clothes in which she was captured and shall remain in your house and lament her father and mother a full month. After that, you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. But look at verse 14. If you no longer delight in her, that's not talking about adultery. It's not talking about fornication. If you just lose interest in her is what that's telling us. You shall let her go where she wants, but you shall not sell her for money, nor shall you treat her as a slave, since you have humiliated her. So divorce was allowed in the Old Testament for more than adultery. That was not the only issue involved, and Deuteronomy 24 seems to be regulating that kind of situation. If adultery was involved, the law was very plain. It required the death penalty. So what you have here then in this particular case, and I'm way behind here, some indecency, it was regulating divorces that were already taking place. It did not specifically address the issue then of adultery. The Lord's, and even though this permitted and regulated divorce under some circumstances, be absolutely clear what the Lord thought about it. You go back to the book of Malachi, chapter 2, verse 16, the Lord said, I hate divorce. And he was talking there about some priests who were divorcing the wives they had been married to for years and gone and found somebody else that they liked. And the Lord said, I'm sick of that. I don't want divorce. We shouldn't read Deuteronomy 24 as Moses or the Lord encouraging divorce. He permitted it, and he said, if it's going to take place, it has to be regulated in a certain way. It has to be done in a certain way. The Lord didn't want divorce. He was not trying to encourage divorce. He was allowing it because of a particular set of circumstances. One other point to make about the Old Testament view of divorce. I know a lot of times when people talk about marriage and divorce, and people say, well, okay, maybe the divorce is unlawful, but man, think about the hard effects on the families and so forth. The best answer I have for that comes from the book of Ezra. When you get to the end of the book of Ezra, Ezra chapters 9 through 11, 9 through 10, there is a listing of people that were guilty of unlawful marriages. And when Ezra found out about it, he and the leaders of the nation had to come together and address the situation. They were gravely concerned about it. They realized they had done what was wrong. And everyone who was involved in this was required to put away the wives of these unlawful marriages. And the last verse of Ezra chapter 10, verse 44, all these had married foreign women. In this case, foreign women, remember you go back to Deuteronomy 7, there was a list of people you could not intermarry with. That's what had happened here. But verse 44 says, all these had married foreign women, and some of the women had even borne children. It didn't matter. It was an unlawful marriage. It had to be dissolved by divorce, and that's what the Lord required. Even though children were sometimes involved, even though there would be the pain of that separation, nonetheless, that's what the law required. So I think it's necessary to understand then the background of Deuteronomy chapter 24 before we get into Jesus' teaching, because that's exactly what's being appealed to. All right, so you turn over to the New Testament. I want to start with just by reading these four key texts about divorce. Jesus addresses it four times in the Gospels. Matthew chapter 5, we're going to read this list. We're going to concentrate on Matthew 19, then we'll come back briefly to this list a little bit later. First time he mentions it in the New Testament is in Matthew chapter 5. In verse 31, it was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. That's a reference to Deuteronomy 24. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife except on the ground of sexual immorality makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Next text is Matthew chapter 19. This was read for us a few minutes ago. If you start in verse 3, it says, the Pharisees came up to him and tested him by saying, is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause? And he answered, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female and said, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. And they said to him, why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and send her away? And he said to them, because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, verse 9, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. Mark chapter 10 is the parallel of that. It is worded slightly different. Mark chapter 10. Now, most everything is the same. I want you to look down in verse 10. And in the house, the disciples asked him again about this matter, and he said to them, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. So there's a little bit of a change of wording there. Luke does not record that particular incident that is recorded in Matthew 19 and Mark chapter 10. He does preserve one saying about divorce in Luke chapter 16, verse 18, but there is no context given. But Luke 16, verse 18, everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, and he who marries a woman divorced from her husband commits adultery. So that's Jesus' basic teaching. Now, when you get to Matthew chapter 19, it is clearly a discussion about the extent to which, or some of the stipulations of Deuteronomy chapter 24. So you go back there, Matthew chapter 19, and look at the Pharisees coming up to him and testing him by saying, is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause? Now, the fact that that they bring up this discussion about Moses' command indicates they are going back to Deuteronomy 24. What they are trying to get Jesus to do is to commit to one of two positions that were prominent in the first century. There were two schools of thought, and it depended on which rabbi you happened to follow. But Rabbi Hillel, in going back to Deuteronomy chapter 24, he underlined the word any. If he finds any indecency in her, and he would underline and circle and highlight the word any, and what he actually meant by that was, if she wasn't a good cook, if you just didn't like her anymore, if she did something to make you mad, Hillel thought, then that is grounds for divorce. He believed it applied to men only. Only men could apply the law of divorce. And he believed that divorce was required. Shammai was at the other end of things. Rabbi Shammai, again in appealing to Deuteronomy chapter 24, believed that the only grounds was immodesty or sexual immorality. Again, Deuteronomy allowed only men to initiate divorce according to him, and he believed it was required. Jesus, however, in dealing with the situation, he just skips Deuteronomy 24 altogether. He said, no, you're looking at the wrong place. You need to go back to the beginning, and that's exactly what he does. Have you not read? This is verse 4 of Matthew 19. Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh? Jesus went all the way back to the beginning. He went all the way back to God's design for marriage as it was instituted after creation, going back to Genesis chapter 1 and 2, particularly the latter part of Genesis chapter 2. What Jesus noted is that Moses' law was descriptive and it was permissive. In the text of Matthew, now I know the wording is a little bit different. If you look in verse 7 of Matthew 19, they said to him, and I truly believe this is how the conversation went. Again, there are some variations in the wording, but this makes sense, again, if you think in terms of how did the Pharisees look at this issue. Why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and send her away? It is true that there was some procedural aspects of Deuteronomy 24, but they seem to emphasize the command part. And Jesus said, because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you, he permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. He's saying, they were emphasizing the command part of it. Jesus emphasized the permissive part of it. Moses allowed you to do it, but it was the hardness of your heart. God was making a concession to the situation that existed in Old Testament times. So I think he's emphasizing there the permissive nature of Moses' law. Also, one other thing, in Jesus' wording, particularly in Mark's account, we'll look at that here in a moment, but in Mark's account, Jesus allowed that either the woman or the man could initiate the divorce. Under Jewish law, particularly in the first century, men were the only ones allowed to initiate the divorce, except under extreme circumstances. So there was a great inequality. Jesus, in his comments in Mark chapter 10, indicate that the woman could initiate it. In that regard, it varied from Jewish law and Jewish custom in the first century. So Jesus didn't take the bait. They come up and say, well, which school are you following? Do you agree with Rabbi Hillel or Rabbi Shammai? He says, I agree with God. I agree with what Genesis said. I agree with what Moses said. And he points to the fact that they were abusing the law for their own self-serving purposes. They had gone beyond what the law said. They were putting emphasis where it could not be. Now, just to summarize a little bit of what Jesus was saying. Number one, marriage was intended from the beginning to be a permanent thing. Number two, there was only one reason for divorce, and that was sexual immorality. And that's where he differed from the law. You go back and look at the law, divorce was allowed for more than one reason. And then divorce and remarriage without cause, as far as Jesus was concerned, it constituted adultery. And it was universally applicable. It applied to both men and women. And a question comes up here. A lot of people look at Matthew chapter 19:9 and the parallels, the one in Matthew 5, Mark 10, Luke 16. Some believe that Jesus was simply here elaborating on the law of Moses, and I do not believe that's the case. In the text of Matthew chapter 19, he says in verse 9, "And I say to you," wow, that takes us back to the Sermon on the Mount, "you have heard it said, but I say to you," Jesus was asserting his own authority in this particular matter. Jesus was emphasizing his law. In the context of Matthew, you go back to Matthew chapter 4. Matthew chapter 4, back in verse 17. If I can get there. Matthew chapter 4, verse 17. "From that time, Jesus began to preach, saying, 'Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand.'" He was teaching kingdom law. This was the law that applied in his kingdom. He wasn't concerned about reestablishing the law of Moses and clarifying that. He does that in an incidental way. But when Jesus says, "I say to you," he is asserting what he taught in his kingdom. This is kingdom law. So it is universally applicable, not just to men and women. It is applicable to Jew and Gentile. This went beyond the law of Moses. This was the law in the kingdom of Jesus Christ. Now, I want to go back to that list. There are some slight differences in the wordings of all four of these passages. Now, some have seized on that and say, well, see, New Testament isn't reliable. Jesus is contradicting himself. What I want to argue is Jesus is simply emphasizing different things in each one of the texts. In the text of Matthew chapter 5, verse 32 and 33, the emphasis here is on the consequences for the put-away wife and for her new husband. In Matthew chapter 19, the emphasis here is upon the consequences for the husband who initiates the divorce. In Mark chapter 10, in that passage, the emphasis is on the consequences for the one who unlawfully puts away his wife, and he doesn't have a biblical reason for it. And also, he shows that a woman could initiate the divorce as well. And finally, in Luke chapter 16, verse 18, the emphasis here is on the consequences for the one who puts away the wife and for the person who marries the one who has been put away. What I think is interesting about all four of these, when you put them together, Jesus answers every situation you can imagine. He does it so compactly in these four passages. He says, look, this covers it all. This is all I got to say about it. This is all I'm going to say. But these are Jesus' words. I say to you, this is kingdom law. Again, some think that Jesus' law applied only to the Jews. That is not true. His wording of it, the fact that it differs from the law of Moses, suggests this is Jesus, or it confirms that this is Jesus' teaching. And another issue that comes up. So you're saying that even people who aren't Christians are bound by this law? Absolutely. This is the law of the kingdom of Christ. Jesus sits on the throne, and this is his law for all marriages. John chapter 12, verse 48, "The one who rejects me and does not receive my words has a judge. The word that I have spoken will judge him on the last day." So this includes people who reject the authority of Jesus. He says, my words will still judge them. And so this law that Jesus gives to us regarding marriage and divorce, that is applicable to all people because he is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Now, one other passage I want to address is from the epistles, Paul's teaching. This one raises a lot of questions. You turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and some see here a different set of conditions. It's called the Pauline privilege. I don't believe it's a privilege. I think Paul here affirms exactly what Jesus said. He's addressing one slightly different aspect of it. He's looking at it from a little bit different perspective. The text here in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, chapters 5, 6, and 7 are all dealing with some issues regarding morality, immorality among Christians in various forms. So he's dealing with that in chapters 5, 6, and 7. Chapter 7 is dealing particularly with some marital issues that apparently the Corinthians were have. If you want to understand the key to 1 Corinthians 7, it is verses 17 through 24. He talks about the principle of remain as you were called. Whatever condition you were called in as a Christian, remain in that set of circumstances. He's largely thinking of social circumstances that they had, and that's the principle in verses 17 through 24. Now, in this particular text, here's the rub, I guess you could say. Well, let me start with this. Let me get back to my chart here. He first reiterates Jesus' principle. Look at how many times he says this. In chapter 7, verse 10, to the married I give this charge, not I, but the Lord, the wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and the husband should not divorce his wife. Look at verse 12, to the rest I say, I, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. Verse 13, if any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. So it sounds like, to me, that Paul is asserting exactly the same thing that Jesus said. Don't divorce. I don't know that it could be much plainer. Now, a lot of people emphasize that little parenthetical thing in verse 12, I, not the Lord. Well, this is Paul's explanation of something different. I do believe that Paul is addressing a different set of circumstances, but he starts out by addressing exactly what the Lord says. He confirms exactly what Jesus said. I say, not the Lord, but guess what? I'm saying exactly the same thing that the Lord did. Don't get divorced. He's not allowing another particular privilege here. And not just here. You go toward the latter parts of the chapter, verse 27. He says, are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be free. Are you free from a wife? Do not seek a wife. And then finally in verse 39 of the text, a wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives. But if her husband dies, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. I don't know how much clearer you can get, but five times in this chapter he says, I'm telling you exactly what Jesus said. And what Jesus said is, don't divorce. But the issue comes up then, the word bondage in verse 15. He paints this scenario. He says, starting in verse 12, if a brother has a wife who is an unbeliever, she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it are, they are holy. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? The ESV there says enslaved. Most other translations say something to the effect of they're not under bondage. And that's the big thing. The word that's used there is doulao, and it meant slavery or servitude. It meant the practical kinds of things that you would expect in a marriage. You have obligations to the other person. It's used in chapter 9, verse 19, same word. Chapter 9, verse 19, where Paul said, for though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all. I am bound to all, he says, that I might win more of them. And the word is used consistently throughout the New Testament to denote things, just basic acts of service. But if you want to talk about the legal aspect of marriage, there is a different word that I think indicates the idea of a legal binding, and that word is found in Romans chapter 7, verse 2. Romans chapter 7, in verse 2, where Paul said, for a married woman is bound by law to her husband while he lives, but if her husband has died, she is released from the law of marriage. And that's repeated, as we saw in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 27. Same basic principle. It's a different word there. They are similar. There is some overlap in meaning. But when Paul is talking about the legal binding of marriage, he uses this second word and not the first one. The first one simply says that if you're married to an unbeliever, the unbeliever gets tired of you and leaves. You are not under bondage in the sense that you don't have to go chase them down. You don't have to keep taking care of them. You have no practical responsibilities to them. I do not believe that Paul here is giving another grounds for divorce. And again, he says five times in the chapter, don't put away your spouse. So I think he's affirming there the same thing that Jesus did. Well, that's a lot of territory. I'm going to make this as simple as I know how to make it. Who has the right to marry as far as the Bible is concerned? Number one, someone who has never married. That's pretty obvious. Number two, someone who was widowed. And we saw that. Romans chapter 7, verse 2. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 27, I believe it was. If you're bound to your husband or spouse as long as they live, if they die, you are free to remarry. So someone who has been widowed. And the only other exception that I believe the Bible permits, I know there are some professed Christians who say, no, you can't get divorced under any circumstances. Jesus said otherwise. Matthew chapter 19, verse 9, if your spouse has committed fornication, if they have been sexually unfaithful to you with another person, you have the right, you have permission to put them away. It is not a command. It is not a requirement. It is an allowance by the Lord. Now, I'm going to make a couple of observations about all of this. I have noticed in recent years, one of the things, this is one of those subjects I hate to preach on. I hate preaching about divorce. I hate preaching about the dissolution of marriage. I hate talking about when marriage has come to the point where it's going to break. That's terrible. That's a terrible thing. And what I've noticed in the last 20 years or so when I've been preaching, sometimes we're just like the Pharisees sometimes. We pounce on Matthew chapter 19 and figure out it's some kind of a race to the courthouse, and we're all about the procedure. I mentioned before a guy I knew years ago, he had been married four times. He had been married four times. Two of his wives, I'm not kidding, tried to kill him. One wife chased him around the kitchen table with a knife trying to slice his head off. Another of his wives tried to run him over in his driveway with their car. This guy had a way of torquing off his wives to a point that they couldn't stand him. He'd been divorced four times. The last wife left him not because of adultery. She just didn't like him anymore. Now, she was a case all her own, trust me. But anyway, she finally got tired of him, decided she wanted to leave, and she left. She just up and left. And he was concerned about whether he had the right to remarry. We finally told him, you just don't need to be married. He was missing the larger picture. Do you remember what Jesus said in Matthew 19? We didn't go that far in the text, but you remember what Jesus said? There's some people who need to be eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom. He needed to be a eunuch. He needed to quit getting married. He didn't know how to do it. He was a selfish, immature man. And it showed up in his marriages. But you know what? We got together with this guy. This guy never came to church. He didn't have a spiritual bone in his body. We got together with the man. We had a study with him. And he quotes Matthew 19, verse 9, by heart, flawlessly, commas and everything. When it came to what Jesus had to say, he was a Pharisee. He wanted to stress, what are my rights? I got the procedure. I got the... No. You've missed it altogether, bud. And sometimes what I've noticed is sometimes we're just like the Pharisees. We're all about the procedures. We're all about dotting the I's and crossing the T's in the matter of divorce. We need to work on having good marriages is what we need to work on. If we put as much effort into having a good marriage as we put into explaining all the laws about divorce, I think a lot of it would take care of itself. But what happens is someone gets tired of this or that and they want out, and they're going to find a way to get out. And I've discovered just through much practical experience, and I hate this, people are not terribly concerned about what Jesus had to say. If they did, probably more likely, we wouldn't have nearly the divorce problem that we have. Yes, Jesus gave a right for divorce in his kingdom, and we need to respect that. And there are legitimate cases where that applies, and you hate it when that situation comes up, you just, it breaks your heart to see it. And sometimes, yes, that applies. But what we need to be concerned about is loving our wives as Christ loved the church. If we'll take that portion of Jesus' teaching seriously, we get a whole lot better results before it's all over with. Now, this is one of those things. God regulates every portion of our lives. Every portion of our lives, every relationship that we have, God regulates. Jesus is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. That means He rules everything, including our marriages. And yes, sadly, including our divorces. So we need to take seriously His authority over every part of our lives. And we need to make sure that what we're doing is following His commands to the best of our ability in any and every circumstance, so that when this kind of situation comes up, we're still trying to do the will of God as we have always been. When we don't do that, trouble comes. Now, you may be here tonight, and if you've never obeyed the gospel, we want to end our services with an invitation to obey Jesus as Lord. And as we said, He rules every part of your life, and you need to take that seriously. And for those of us who are Christians, sometimes we don't pay attention to what Jesus says. Sometimes we're self-willed, we're stubborn, we want to do what we want to do. And when that's the case, bad things always happen. If you're here tonight and subject to Christ's invitation in any way, we invite you to come forward while we stand and sing.